You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
For over 40 years, Greenbelt has been programming and spotlighting the struggle in Palestine. And we continue to do so. We continue to learn and love. We can continue to work out ways we can seek justice and work out ways we can stand in solidarity with our friends in Palestine. This year, as last year, Palestine Action remains a proscribed terrorist organisation under the UK law. And whatever we think about that decision, Greenbelt as a festival, as a charity, as a public event, has to work with inside this law. Not least because we don't want to make life difficult for our Palestinian guests and speakers at the festival. We want this to be a place of safety and a place where people can speak to their lived experience. So as we enter into this session and as we go through the festival together, Greenbelt asks for your understanding and your good grace as we navigate towards this. There's something I really love about Greenbelt, which is we can talk about hard things with each other. And in this session, we have two lovely humans with us, which are our members of the wellbeing team, and they are in the light blue tabards. We are here for you. If you experience something hard in this session or anything that you've experienced so far in the festival, our lovely humans are here for a chat and to give you some kindness. So if you need that, please, please take that up. And with no further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Ian. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Ian, and I'm a staff member for the Iona community who are hosting this Wild Goose venue over the weekend. So delighted to be able to introduce you to our speakers for this session. The Iona community has got a long-standing concern, just like Greenbelt, for the position in Palestine. And as part of that, we have one of our common concern networks is the Israel-Palestine Common Concern Network. There's a position paper, so if you're interested in finding out more, then you can search Iona Community Israel-Palestine and you should be able to find our position paper on there. There's also a few members, so if you're interested in knowing more, go to the bookstall or the stall over there at the end of the session, and someone who is connected to the Iona community can also tell you more about our links there. So I'm now going to pass over to Sally for the next bit of the session.
Thank you. Before we start, I want to say a huge thank you to Lama for agreeing to spend some time with us. She's been kept very, very busy. So thank you for being with us. And I'll let Lama introduce herself in a minute. I am Sally Foster Fulton. I'm the UK and Global Churches Ambassador for Christian Aid. And like Greenbelt and Wild Goose, Christian Aid has been working in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory for over 60 years. We have had to adapt and move as things have deteriorated and become even more difficult. I spoke briefly with our head of humanitarian, William Bell, and he gave me some information that I hope I can share during the conversation with Lama. But the one thing he said for me not to let not be said is that the work that is being done by the local communities. The only way that we can make anything happen in those spaces in Gaza and in the occupied territory is through the local communities. And one of the things that Lama said this morning in another panel that she was on is, let's not romanticize hope. Let's not make it something that is effortless, that hope costs something, that it's hard, and sometimes it hurts. And I'll let her speak more about that, but I want us to hold on to that as we look at where we find hope and that releasing of our imagination under occupation. Let's not forget how hard hope can be. So I'm going to ask Lama to introduce herself. I could do it, but you know, I'm not all about that. I think it's better when someone tells you for themselves. But welcome, we're so glad you're here. So if you could just introduce yourself and then tell us a little bit about what brings you to Greenbelt and what not gives you hope, but what you hope for in this space.
Thank you so much for coming and spending the afternoon with us. I can hear the music, so we're competing with a lot of good music and the thunder. As was said, my name is Lama Mansour. I was born and raised in Nazareth. I'm now based in Jerusalem. Sorry, I have to focus with the rain. By training, I'm a sociologist. I work with young people, thinking about how young people find belonging and cultivate identity in contexts of violence. So I specifically work with Palestinians inside of Israel, communities inside of Israel. And I think I'll tell you a story about kind of why I became so interested in hope. Mm-hmm. As a Christian. Maybe 10 years ago, I became interested in these conversations about how, as people of faith, as Palestinians, how do we navigate the reality of violence around us? How do we respond faithfully to realities of violence? And being in spaces such as Greenbelt and other places in Christian communities, a lot of people we would ask the question about hope. What gives you hope? And I would give certain answers, and they never sat quite right with me. And then in 2024, so April 2024, less than a year after the war on Gaza started, I was asked to give a talk. And it was just after Easter. And in Easter, as elsewhere in the world, we talk a lot about hope. And that confronted me. What does hope look like when I'm in Bethlehem or I'm in Jerusalem, 60 kilometers away from Gaza? Bombs are still being dropped on people. My kin, my friends, families, we're living in fear. What does that hope look like? And through tears, I gave that talk. And God showed me that hope is not naive. It's not optimism. So I often say I'm not optimistic, but I am hopeful. Because optimism is about looking at the world around us and looking for signs of goodness or signs that things are getting better. And they're not. There aren't many signs that things are getting better. But the hope we have is rooted in God and who God is. And so that is not cheap hope. That is hope that is costly. And so picking up on some of those threads, Sally, that you raised.
Thank you, Lama. Again, going back to some of the things in my conversation with William Bell that he asked not only to share with you, but to share with you. Because one of the things that we talked about was the occupation of the imagination and how during that occupation, hope gets suffocated. And what that does not only to the group being oppressed, but to the entire, to everyone. And he really grappled with that. And he came up with two or three examples from local initiatives that said there was a spark of we're not going to lose hope, and we're going to have to think outside the box here. We're going to use our imaginations. And one is a small group of activists, some second or third generation refugees, and some second and third generation settlers. And they have come together, and they come together every week. But what they are doing is, rather than seeing each other as the way it's always going to be, they've come up with a way of expressing things, and they are working together to build a plan to rebuild Jaffa, to be a place where everyone can be together, where everyone can thrive, where everyone is equal. And rather than just saying that can't happen, they are building a plan. And they said that gives them hope, and they share that hope. It doesn't have to be this way, and in fact, we've got a plan. So that was one. Another is one of our partners, PARC, which is Palestinian Agricultural Development. And in Gaza, there was a warehouse that was bombed. And in the warehouse, it was an entire warehouse full of powdered milk, which was useless because people don't have access to clean water. But rather than just saying, oh, well, there's nothing we can do, that local group, we purchased that warehouse full of powdered milk. They processed it, turned it into milk, and then turned it into cheese, which could then be put in the food parcels that they send out in Gaza. Sparks of hope, sparks of imagination, not to romanticize it, but just to say things are happening, but they happen at that local level. I wanted to hear more, and I think everyone, more about the work you do with young people and how, where they find hope, where they find purpose in a time when things are so, as you said, we're not optimistic. Things are hard. What do you do with your work with young people? What are some of the tangible things that you do?
I want to pick up on something you said about imagination, and then I'll talk more about, and I think that connects to young people. I remember reading an excellent book by a human rights lawyer called Jonathan Kuttab. He's a Christian Palestinian. And he has a small book, a very short book, quite technical actually, called Beyond the Two-State Solution. And whatever we think about two-state, one-state, but he wrote this book. And in it, he kind of sets forth a vision for what a one-state could look like. And I remember reading that. And in one part, he says, in this vision for one-state, the wall will have to come down. And I remember leaving the book and my eyes filling up with tears, because I realized in that moment that I have never thought that the wall will come down. It's become such an entrenched part of reality. We're driving past it every day, my friends' homes right by it. I couldn't imagine it being falling down. And that's the occupation of the imagination. And I realized at that moment that we cannot let actors of violence and agents of violence and oppressors control our imagination. We have to let Jesus do that, shape our imagination for a better world. So those initiatives, I think, are signs of God, of God's work in the world, of living out what the Jesus way is in the world. And so I think those and other initiatives where really we work out, we live the future that God has for the world right now, even when it's hard. And that is what gives me hope. That is the hope. Young people, I think along similar lines, do not want to be victims nor heroes. I think that's the main message I would say from work with research with young people across the past few years. They recognize the really difficult reality, and a lot of people want to leave. We talked a bit about this morning, that a lot of people want to go and look for better lives elsewhere with employment opportunities, education, which is understandable. But a lot of people are looking for reasons to stay, and trying to find reasons to stay and a way to stay. And they don't want to just be victims of the occupation, but they also don't want to be portrayed as heroes, because that's also dehumanizing. And so they're trying to find their way between that. Can say a lot more about that, but I'll keep it there.
No, thank you for that. I remember, you reminded me, I remember when I was in Israel in the occupied territory years ago, and that and the wall, and kind of facing the reality of that wall that snakes in and out. So it's quite insidious.
Yeah.
And there were murals, and there was this incredible mural of, and it was a face of a child, and the head lifted up, sounds terrible, but, and a bird was flying out with a key, and it was so evocative, painful to see in the reality of that, you know, refugee camp that is actually a town with buildings. And, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, refugees meant to be, we're here for a little while and then we go back, and that's not the reality that you live with. But to see that and to say, you know, you cannot, you know, the imagination is a human right. How do we hold on to that human right to become when you're under such threat and occupation? You know, when you said that, it reminded me of that, you know, very evocative image, you know, when faced with that reality.
I think I want to say something provocative. Mm-hmm. when it comes to the imagination, mm-hmm. Agents of violence in the world say, it's always going to be this way. There's always going to be violence. It's just going to be more oppression. It's mm-hmm. just, you have to, there is no alternative, right? There is no other way. And in some ways, we sometimes as Christians, we say the same. I hear phrases like, oh, there won't be peace anyway until Jesus comes. Well, what do we do in the meantime? And so we mirror sometimes that discourse, that narrative. And if our calling was just to wait for Jesus to return and then for all things to be made new, then Jesus would have called us to be peace waiters, but we are peacemakers, oh, right? Wow. There's something active in that. And so let's not mirror those narratives. And I think that is one key part of unlocking an imagination of the kingdom of God rather mm-hmm. than an imagination of empires, of violence and of oppression.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Yeah. It reminds me, I go back to, you know, when you said the kingdom of God is at, you know, the kingdom of God is at hand means it's right here. It doesn't mean it's in the never. It's right here, but you're going to have to work to get it. So it's right here. It's at hand. So reach for it. Reach for it. It's not going to be easy, but it's here. And another, just when you said that, when we talk about some of our Christian euphemisms or kind of our get out of guilt free or responsibility free cards, you know, the poor are always with us, will always be with us. It's not what it says. That's not what it says. What it says is need will always be with us. That's not the same as systemic injustice that keeps people poor. That's not inevitable. That's a choice. That's a choice. The occupation is a choice. It's a political choice that somebody's making. And how do we push back against that violation of humanity? You know, and I'm so glad you said that about our propensity sometimes to just say, we're just going to love everybody, it'll be all right. It's complicated. And to own the complication doesn't mean we have to have the answers. But as long as we continue, at least we need to keep asking the questions. Yeah.
I mean, that's, and I mentioned the best version of that discourse. The worst version of that discourse is apocalyptic, Gog and Magog. This all needs to happen for Christ to come. And we wouldn't accept it for ourselves. If I told you that Britain had to be in war for 100 years in order for Christ to come, would you accept it? And you would have to be displaced from your homes in order for Christ. Would you accept it? No, but we accept it for people far away from us who are maybe not the right color or right whatever. I won't go into there. But that's kind of, that's the maybe worst version of that. There's nothing we can do. This will just always there will always be violence. When you start, when we start to justify it theologically through eschatological, certain eschatological readings, certain Zionist readings of the scriptures, and then the Bible becomes a weapon. A tool of war rather than, rather than a tool of peace.
Yeah, and it would be interesting looking at the Bible and our sacred stories as a tool of peace and also of resistance. You know, there's conventional wisdom that is in the Bible, but there's also subversive wisdom that turns it upside down and says, well, actually, it's another way of looking at this. You know, that peace is hard come by, but it's the road we travel. What kind of, in your lived experience, where are those pieces of subversive wisdom that you can access and that you've seen accessed in your spaces?
You mean in scripture where it's used, or
yeah, or in kind of where you find hope in those spaces, where you find the capacity to resist?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in some of the stories you shared, I think in sometimes people say that Palestinians are resilient people. I think we're a very stubborn people. We refuse to be, you know. And I think that gives me hope in a way. Just the stubbornness and the unwillingness to surrender that this is, you know, to be victims or heroes, to be enemies, to have our land turn into a place of bloodshed and war, and so there's, in that stubbornness, I find a lot of subversive wisdom, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was some of the stuff that again, going back to conversations with William and some of the partners that are in Gaza, you know, the refusal to let horrible obstacles, you know, consistent bombing, you know, spaces being, they're just gone. So, you know, moving from a clinic where people can congregate to mobile clinics, even to the point where people, medics are going on bicycles or walking to make sure that they can still help people, refusing to give up, refusing to say there's nothing else that we can do. And I keep going back to your don't romanticize it. Because it, you know, it would be easy to say, isn't that wonderful and amazing and let's go off with a warm fuzzy. But it's appalling that that's happening. It's galling that it's continuing. So I guess my question, not just to you, because we talked earlier about us, we could have a conversation forever. But I actually want to hear the wisdom in the room and the questions in the room. So in a minute, we're going to open it up for questions to Lama. And comments from you, but that space where we find hope. When you talked about not being victims or heroes, so what is there? You know, when you were talking about the Exodus, so many people leaving, choosing to leave, what helps them choose to stay?
I'll tell you a story about my grandfather. Mm. My grandfather passed away in February, a week before his 92nd birthday. My grandfather, in 1948, when the Nakba happened, when the Palestinian catastrophe, the war that produced the Israeli state happened, he was in Lebanon. He's from Jish, which is a village that's 5 kilometers away from Lebanon. And he was about 12, maybe. And he was in Lebanon because his village only had primary schooling. Mm. And his dad had sent him to Lebanon to pursue his secondary education. Or not high school even, but like 6th or 7th grade. And upon, you know, the war, he came back. to his village and, you know, understood what had happened and understood and received the Israeli citizenship and worked. His father was a farmer. He was a farmer, so he worked in the farm. And once he understood that the Israelis were here to stay and that he needed to be able to communicate mm-hmm. with them, he went and lived in a kibbutz, learned Hebrew. And because he said, if these are going to be my neighbors, I have to be able to speak to them on my own terms. I have to understand their language. I have to be able to extend a hand of peace. I have a role here. And one day he heard the prime minister at the time, Ben-Gurion, saying something about young people. And he didn't mention the Palestinians. Hmm. And so he wrote him a letter telling him, you didn't mention the Palestinians. What about us? What do we have to say? And surprisingly, Ben-Gurion wrote back and told him, come visit me. And he came and visited, and he went. He got a permit from the military commander, and he went and visited Ben-Gurion and then wrote about it and then became the first Palestinian journalist to write in Hebrew for an Israeli newspaper. For me, that story and my grandfather's stubbornness that we are going to stay here, both peoples, we're going to stay here. We have to communicate with each other. I have to put in the effort to understand my enemy / neighbor's language, to speak to them on their own level, not lessen myself in order to speak to them and not for them to be, we have to be on the same eye level, and that we can challenge narratives of supremacy while also remaining human. Mm-hmm. I think that is where the crux of it lies. Mm-hmm. And for me, one of the reasons why I stay in the land is because of that. It's because I was raised on the fact, the faith, the belief, the conviction that we have a role to play. Mm-hmm. That we often say it in Arabic, like, if we leave, who stays? Yes. Yes. And if the living stones leave, then all that we're left with is are the old stones and the churches and the buildings. So we have a role to play, mm-hmm. to continue to talk, to continue to extend hands of being bridges mm-hmm. for our communities. And that is why we stay. And this is what what the church, even though it's very tired and exhausted, is trying to give to the next generation. Mm-hmm. Out of a place, strength, not out of a place of weakness, but out of a place of strength. And maybe faithful stubbornness.
Yeah. And yeah. And faithful stubbornness and a refusal to hate yes. can be profoundly rattling to those who choose violence. I visited Umm el-Qahir, tiny village. And at the very top is a settlement, and below is a factory. And so the settlers go past the village to work in the factory. But at Umm el-Qahir, at that point, and I think still, no running water, no electricity, cut off from everything. Met with a guy who was absolutely wonderful, master's in engineering. He was born in that village. He chose to stay. And he said exactly that. If we leave, who stays? If we leave, we can't come back. And so we stay. There was also the most radical welcome I've ever experienced. We got there and taken into their community hall, which was a tent, and served tea. In a place with no running water and no electricity. That type of radical embodied love and persistence and determination, the Tent of Nations refused to hate. We will not hate, even though it would be totally understandable if you did. So thank you for that story. Before we open it up, any final words for Greenbelt? Again, earlier I was really made me think. Somebody said, well, you know, we don't have the capacity to make decisions about what's good, what you could do here. Figure it out for yourselves, which I thought was really good. But while we're here together, what are some of the things that would bring you hope?
I mean, I've been in places where I have to convince people that we're humans, or that the Palestinian cause is a worthy one. I don't think Greenbelt is quite that, yeah. So I'm glad first. I think the step for all of us at Greenbelt and for people who are already allies is to think of how we don't turn Palestine only into a humanitarian issue. These people just need more food or more water or more tents, or this is fundamentally about freedom. And freedom is political. And so I think that's the first thing I would leave us with, is do not turn Palestine just into something to sympathize with, but something to take action on. And then the second thing we always say is come and see and go and tell. So if you can, come. The land is hurting. Mm. People are hurting. I've lived in Jerusalem for a year, and every time I go to the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it's empty. Usually you can't, it's packed. Usually you can't put a foot in. Now it's empty. People are missing visitors and people who are coming to be with them. So if you can, come. Have tea with us. Listen to the stories of people who can't come, like me, come to Greenbelt and tell you the stories. So come and see. And then once you come and see, go and tell. Go tell our stories in the places we can't go. So the question from this morning about what do I tell my MP? I can't be with your MP. I can't be with your elected officials. I can't vote in the UK if you don't have an election coming up, I don't think. But wherever you can be and we can't, please take our stories. Please take our voices. Because it matters. It matters so much. So, so much. Yeah.
Thank you. We're going to do something really brave. We're going to ask questions. And the reason I say brave is we don't have a roving mic. And the rain is making it. Okay. But Ian will go. He will go. If you raise your hand, Ian will come and hear your question. You bellow it. But otherwise, Ian will come and tell us what the question is. And we'll make it happen. There's so many. Why don't you start at the back and come forward? So there's a gentleman at the back.
You said earlier this morning you'd take lessons from history, that the Berlin Wall fell, that others, it was an encouragement to keep courage, that the wall will fall.
Thank you. Do you know what? I've had a different idea. We will come to you if you can't come to us, but rather than this back and forth, then why don't you come and say your question, and then we don't have to double down on it. So who would like, please come up. Thank you.
Thank you. I know how costly this must be for you, and I'm very grateful for your wisdom and your courage. I was in Palestine recently, and the thing that haunts me really is the number of Palestinians who said to me, independently of each other, what do human rights mean anymore? And it strikes me that that is an area that we can use with our MPs, because our MPs would be quite keen to talk about human rights and upholding human rights, but we know that there are terrible double standards applied to human rights. And I don't know if you have any reflections on that question of human rights and why so many Palestinians are saying, what does it mean anymore?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think because we, I think people are, Palestinians are asking that question because we got the degrees. People told us for the longest times, you have to make your case in international law. So people went and got degrees in international law and made the cases and wrote the books and made the, you know, gave the lectures and all of that. Only then to find out they don't apply to us. And I think there's a deep disappointment with the liberal world order, whatever you want to call it, with the systems that we set up after World War II, where international law was supposed to mean something, and it doesn't anymore, at least when it's applied. And people in the whatever global south, whatever you, the terminology you want to use, we've known for a while that those the standards aren't quite the same, but it was so stark in Gaza in the past 3 years. And I would say, just to add to that, I would say that I hesitate to say this because I don't, I hesitate to say this, but I think Palestine has uncovered something about the state of international law in general. And if now we don't say, no, this stops here, this will happen everywhere. And we've already seen this happen in many places in the world. So either there are rules or there aren't. And if there aren't, God have mercy on our world.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll hold it. You just go.
This is slightly different tack, but yeah. I'm a priest in England. I struggle to engage young people. You're a young person, relatively to me anyway. Yeah. And you talk very movingly about faithful stubbornness. Could you just say a word about the place of faith within young people and whether faith is lively or whether there's a sense of God has abandoned us, or, you know, where are young people especially in that place of what's God doing in the land?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I can't speak for all young people in Palestine. But I think there's been a real... That question of where is God amidst all of it has been very, very alive. Where is God when... Yeah, I don't have to tell you the facts of what's going on in Gaza, but where is God amidst all of that? But the other question that gets asked almost as much is, where is the church amidst all of that? And so a lot of the young people I worked with have said, okay, like, you've raised us, like telling their parents, like, you've raised us on all of these values. Now we're applying them. And now you don't want to, like, now you're saying we're too political or too this or too that. So there's a question of where is God, but there's also a question of where is the church. And I think young people are really engaging with questions of faith these times. And I thank God for voices like Pastor Munder Isaac, who, in, I think, an act of grace from God, gave the answer in December of 2023 as he was trying to give pastoral care to his congregation who were asking, where is God? Gave the answer of, God is in the rubble in Gaza, with us, hurting with us, but is also victorious. And that is the tension, that is the mystery of God that we are all still grappling with. And so I'm sorry if that doesn't quite answer your question, but it's, I think once you meet young people where they are, you'll find that there are many more questions. And I think the church can do a lot more to sit with those questions honestly and struggle alongside young people in those questions rather than try to give the ready-made answers that we've all rehearsed in apologetics class, which I'm grateful for those classes, but also we might be needing something a bit more human. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes the Sunday school party line or the flannel board answer isn't cutting it.
Or you have to sit with it. You just have to sit with the question sometimes until you reach. Yeah.
Oh, hi. I'm asking this on behalf of a Greenbelter who'd find it difficult to come to the front. And they'd heard that there was perhaps an issue with the prohibition of use of the Arabic language, yeah, and wondered if you could say something about that.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for that question. I could answer on so many levels. Let's see where we start from. So until 2018, Arabic was an official language of the State of Israel. And then there was a law, like a basic law, which is sort of similar to a constitutional law, but Israel doesn't have a constitution. So anyway, there was a law that was passed in 2018 called the Nation State Law, which defined Israel as a Jewish state only, and that the right of self-determination is reserved only to Jews. And one of the other things that this law did is strike Arabic as one of the official languages of the state and kept Hebrew. And so that started devaluing the use and the status of the Arabic language inside Israel. 20% of the population of Israel are Arabic speakers, are Palestinians such as myself. And our first language is Arabic. Ever since October 2023, I don't go on public transportation and speak Arabic. It's risky. Especially after October 7th, a lot of Israeli Jews have started to associate Arabic with terrorism. And a lot of the Israeli public is very, very militarized and has so many weapons have been distributed since October 2023. And so my logic is, someone hears me speaking in Arabic, they can't understand what I'm saying, and they have a gun. So it's too risky. What's happened recently is, maybe this is what you're referring to, is that there were doctors in Haifa who are Palestinian, who were speaking to one another. The whole staff was Palestinian, but they're in an Israeli hospital in Haifa, which is in the north in Galilee. And they were speaking to one another in Arabic. And this patient complained about them, and it became this whole storm of whether Arabic can be spoken in public. And a lot of people say no. A lot of Israeli Jews say no. It's this culture of distrust. It's really sad to me, as someone who loves the Arabic language, who thinks that language is a part of our culture. It's as I said, like, when you look at the situation, there aren't many reasons to hope. There aren't many reasons to be optimistic, because things like this are being happened. When your very identity is being attacked, when your very language is being attacked, it's quite oppressive, and it's the constrictions are coming one after the other, and you don't know where to start from. Like, you don't know where to start resisting from. For now, we will continue to speak in Arabic. We will continue to write in Arabic. We will continue to sing in Arabic, despite the cost.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cool. So you've just been speaking about some of the restrictions that are placed on culture and identity. And obviously your research is in how young people develop their identity in these really hostile environments. So what are you discovering? What is giving your young people identity in these violent situations?
Yes. Thank you. We've come up with this in one of the research projects that I was doing. We've come up with this term for what's happening, is forming pockets of belonging. So amidst these systems that were not made for you, So if you're a Palestinian young person who has to go to university, an Israeli university, or has to work in a workplace that doesn't allow you to speak in Arabic or whatever it is, or is discriminatory, you find that young people, Palestinian young people, form pockets of belonging within that. And that can mean looking out for one another in various ways. So during escalations, one of the things that they do is have WhatsApp groups where if there's someone on their own, they can talk to one another and keep each other company until they get home, so they get home safe. Or they organize taxis to go and be somewhere safe. Or so little pockets of belonging, of safety, of so these when formal safety structures aren't there, or that they pose a threat to you, then young people are able to form alternative structures and systems of security and safety and belonging. And that's one of the really striking things. And it shows up in a lot of different ways. And digital means are a part of that, but also non-digital means. We're seeing a trend in the later generations that they're moving away from phones, which is interesting. And really wanting that in-person sensation and feeling.
Yeah. Thank you. Somebody at the back. Yeah, if you want.
Thank you for your courage and illuminating and bearing witness. It's challenging. And I hope this isn't a naive question, but I just wondered what the state of academia is right now. Who are the thinkers and the researchers and the writers, and how are they surviving and how are they connecting?
It's a really good question, and I'll speak about it in maybe three, and I'll try to stay brief. The state of higher education in Gaza is all of the universities in Gaza have been bombed. There's no kind of, all of them have been bombed, and because of the way that things have been set up, a lot of the academics have left. Those who haven't been killed have left because they are the ones with the visas and the connections to the outside world. It's a sad reality, but that's the way it is. I will say there is still a desire to be educated and to continue. So we've seen videos and pictures of people defending their PhD theses from tents amid bombing. So there's also that. Like I know there are a lot of initiatives where students from inside Gaza are still working towards their degrees and getting educated either from people outside or from the few professors that remain inside Gaza. So that's kind of the first part of it. In the West Bank, universities like Bir Zeit University, next to Ramallah, just outside of Ramallah, they have incursions almost monthly where the army comes in, arrests professors, students, and just goes and smashes labs or whatever it is. So that attack, while it's not the same as Gaza, but there are also attacks on Palestinian academia in the West Bank. There's a lot of good research coming out despite all of this, and authors and poets and educators who are still writing. And I would really recommend, if you want to read young Palestinian writers, search We Are Not Numbers. There's a great platform called We Are Not Numbers by young authors from Gaza mainly, who speak about their daily lives and just write short blog posts that I really love just checking every once in a while, poems and short stories and so on. And then the third part of that I want to mention very briefly is Israeli academia. I'm currently in Israeli academia. I do my work at Hebrew University. And it's very, very difficult. Like saying, being critical inside Israeli academia was hard before October 2023. Now it's almost impossible. Academia is very recruited into the war effort. And during the first, during the first 2 years, maybe, of the war in Gaza, the universities were helping develop the weapons, helping, giving support to the reserves and all of that. So on the one hand, you have Palestinian academia in the state that it is, and Israeli academia, also part of the academic community more broadly, being on the complete opposite end. Although there are critical voices inside of Israeli academia, although they're being very suppressed and under a lot of intimidation. So sorry, that was a long answer, but...
Thank you. Just to check, if there are folk who would find it difficult to come to the front, but they want to ask a question, Ian is very happy to come and relay your question here. So just put your hand up. I think there's a gentleman there.
My father was Jewish. The only way I can make sense of that is by becoming a member of IJAN, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. I'd like to think about something like Rabbis for Human Rights. And is that of any effect at all?
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for that. Yes. There's so many thoughts in my mind. Let me just organize them. Groups like Rabbis for Human Rights, other Jewish Israeli groups who work against the occupation, B'Tselem, other Jewish Israeli groups who work, who fight for human rights, for Palestinian human rights, are few in numbers, but they're very big in terms of their impact. First, to say that this is not a religious issue. This is not a Jew versus Muslim versus Christian issue. This is a political issue. And so that's important to have a different voice coming from inside Israel and from within the Jewish community inside Israel. It's very, very important. And they're some of the best allies that I have and some of my closest friends. And I think, their work is being constricted because the state of Israel understands how important that work is. So Rabbis for Human Rights, for example, does a lot of work of protective presence. So if there are a group of Palestinians who are harvesting their olives, for example, they're subject to a lot of attacks from settlers. So what Rabbis for Human Rights and other organizations do is have the presence of either foreigners or Jewish Israelis be with those Palestinians as shields. And now we're seeing that even with protective presence, a lot of times settlers come and attack. So their work is being constricted, but it's still so important. And so thank you for that.
Thank you. We've got time for one more question, if there is one. Gentleman at the back. Oh.
Yeah, it's asking about the protective presence and how people in Britain can be part of that. Do you want to speak to that?
So one of the ways to do that is through EAPI, the Ecumenical Partnership. The avenues that I know about are EAPI. Tent of Nations, they also welcome people to come and spend time at the Tent of Nations, and that's part of that protective presence there. And again, I would say, go and find out. But those are two avenues that you could access, and if they could at least be pointers in the right direction.
Also, Sabil Kairos and Amos Trust.
Thank you. Sabil Kairos and Amos Trust. Yep. Thank you. Thank you.
And I know that Rabbis for Human Rights does have some program, but I, after October 2023, a lot of the insurance companies won't insure people coming in to do that type of work. So it's become a little bit more complicated, but there are ways to do that safely. So if you are interested, please look for ways to do that.
Thank you. And thank you all for your participation, for the wisdom in the room. But before I hand back to Greenbelt, I just wanted to say a huge thank you. I don't know about you, but I'm going to be going around with this in my head and my heart for a long, long time. So thank you so very much for what you've done.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.